Bonjour!
Kamusta? I'm Ting Claraval.
And I'm Dr. Catherine Wu. And you're listening to the Cultural Quotient Podcast.
More people than ever are working across cultures, and this can be challenging.
In this show, we discuss ideas, strategies, and stories to help you navigate cultural diversity at work and in life.
Like many of us, I've worked in different places like the Philippines, China, and now here in Singapore.
And I've been studying cultural intelligence for 2 decades in Europe and in Asia.
In this first season of the Cultural Quotient, we talk about how to develop CQ so that you can be more successful in today's diverse world. Enjoy!
So I was just thinking, let's go back to basics. I realized we jumped straight into cultural intelligence with the assumption that everybody understands what culture is because, you know, it's like we're all in it. We all see it, feel it. We're operating in culture, but how do you define culture? So give me the straight definition of culture.
So there are many definitions of culture. The one that we like to use is that culture is a set of rules. Okay. It's just the way we do things.
Mm. Give me the complex definition. What would be considered components of culture, right? Yeah. What do the rules cover?
So the more complex definition of culture is the solutions to problems.
So culture as solutions to problems.
To problems. Mm. So the first problem is, how do the members of a group, of a community, of a collective coexist? That only requires two people to create a culture using that definition. When you start living with someone, maybe it's your life partner, maybe it's your roommate, naturally you are going to develop certain kind of rules and practices to solve the problems of how do we live together, how do we coexist in that relatively limited space so that we don't hate each other after a week or two, right?
Yeah.
The second set of problem of external adaptation.
Okay.
It's adaptation to our environment.
Right.
If you take the example of Singapore, Singapore has limited natural resources.
Mm.
Limited natural resources means scarcity of
space.
But also of food, energy, you know, water.
Even people, right? Talent is also scarce because it's a small population.
Exactly. Yeah. So that leads the government to create certain laws and regulations that people have to follow. So even the political system and economic system, all of that is also
rooted
cultural.
In culture. Yes, absolutely.
If you think of the Philippines is an country made of islands. I mean, you're going to tell me how many islands?
7,000.
Okay,
7,107.
So that's a problem of external adaptation. How do you rule a country, a society with so many islands? So this is the more extensive definition of culture. Culture is solution to problems of one, internal integration, maintaining the cohesion of the society and the group, and two, external adaptation.
Yeah, yeah. So you're blowing my mind with these definitions, especially the internal one. I never realized that that culture can exist in, like what you said, between two people, you can have a culture. And I'm thinking about my, you know, living situation. I have flatmates, there are three of us. And we do have a culture. I realized like, oh yes, actually, the three of us, we have a culture at home, you know, which is we don't bother each other. We're just flatmates. Versus earlier when I was living with flatmates who were more my friends, the culture was a little bit more intimate. It was a little bit more warm. We hang out in the living room and chat. But now we don't. Everybody just buggers off into their own bedroom. Nobody bothers anyone. And I guess it works because, it's the best way to avoid conflict, I guess. Nobody wants to live in a stressful household. The basic rules we have is, you know, everybody cleans up after themselves. Nobody cares what you do in your bedroom, but in the kitchen, obviously, you know, in the living room, in the hallway, in the dining area, keep things clean. So I'm trying to just bring it down to earth, but it's just a realization to me like, oh my God, even at that small level, that is culture.
Yeah. And I think your example highlights one thing that's also very important is that culture is not clear cut.
Mm.
And culture evolves and change because it has to be negotiated.
Yes.
You very seldom from the beginning, you say, okay, here are going to be our rules. Sometimes it's discussed openly, but sometimes it's just emerge and evolve. And sometimes we can never get to the point where we actually create a rule that everybody is aligned on.
Yeah.
That's why culture is messy.
Mm.
And that's why within the culture, you will always have a lot of contradictions and a lot of tensions.
Yeah. Yeah, no, but at least the culture kind of like sets that baseline.
Yeah,
like sets the parameters for how we should all interact and operate. Mm. Whenever I think of culture, and this is why I was thinking about the definition of culture, because it's always connected to words like mores, standards, values. So that's why on the way over here, I was just thinking like, oh yeah, we haven't defined actually what is culture and what it covers. And it's taken for granted. It's like the air you breathe, right? It's just there.
And actually, I love that you say that it's like the air you breathe, because this is what I often tell my students. You remember a few years ago, there was a period where we had this haze in Singapore.
Oh, yes.
For like 2 weeks or even a month that we couldn't breathe, right? Because we were in the smog.
Yeah.
And this is at those moments that we start recognizing how important that air we breathe is to us. It's when we cannot breathe that air anymore.
Yes.
And I tell people, you know, you don't realize your culture until you're actually confronted with a situation where somebody does things in ways that feel so foreign, so different from you. Just like when, you know, during that time we were not able to breathe anymore.
Yeah. So, you know, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, right? Kind of.
It's yes, like, and also you don't know how much your environment has shaped you until you go into a radically different environment where anything you know about how to communicate, how to relate is actually challenged because people do it so differently.
Yeah. No, you're right. And like previously we were talking about, this is what makes travel so valuable.
Yeah.
Because it's a physical taking yourself out of what you're used to.
That's right.
And it plants you into an alien environment wherein suddenly you're forced to think about even the simplest things like how to say hello, how to greet people, how to eat, you know, things that you take for granted on a daily basis.
And I will say not only travel, but also collaborations. For the past several years, I've been working on a project with a group of universities from all around the world, and most of the members come from Europe.
Mm.
And one thing that I noticed from the beginning of that project was it was not clear to me who was in charge, who was the leader, who was responsible for making the decisions and setting the directions.
Uh-huh.
Because in reality, nobody and everybody was in charge of doing this, which is a way of relating and working that is what we call low power distance. You know, there is little hierarchy in that group. It was also not very clear who was doing what until very close to the end. And that makes me very anxious.
Yeah.
And I realized this has to do with my experience working in Singapore. Singapore is a culture which is very hierarchical. So you always know who is in charge.
Who's doing what.
Who is doing what. And then it's also very high in what we call uncertainty avoidance.
Yeah.
So for every plan that people make, you have other contingency plans just in case.
Yes.
People will send you reminders. So I had come to expect all of this to be happening. But in that project, none of this was happening.
Yeah.
And yet, the magical thing happened that we ended up still getting things done.
Mm.
Because everybody knew what they had to do.
Mm.
And they just went in and they just did it. And
but how was that decided? Like, for instance, let's say I'm the specialist in this area. I just assume I'll take that part of the project on. Is that how? Okay.
Yes.
Got it.
Yes. Because in cultures that are less hierarchical, there is a higher level of individual autonomy and individual accountability.
Yeah.
But it's not said. It's not explicit. People know and then they would just step up and then they will do it.
Yeah.
As I was having that experience, I had just realized 13 years I've spent in Singapore has really reshaped my expectations of how things ought to be done. That it's not the same everywhere. So any opportunities that we have to engage at a relatively deep and high stake level with people from different parts of the world is going to challenge our expectations to a point that we don't necessarily realize it when we get into it.
And you've mentioned a number of terms there that I feel we might need to define a little bit more, like power distance and uncertainty avoidance, right? Which I believe are the dimensions of culture. Some of the dimensions of culture, as you know, outlined by Geert Hofstede. But before I even go there, so power distance, explain it. And I wonder if if this is something that relates to my story about the culture of where I work, I have similar experiences to that story about your student that you shared before, wherein we get into meetings, we get into calls, you're discussing, I start explaining, and then I get cut off by somebody else talking. And at the beginning, I just like, okay, sit back, listen, you know, let them talk, and then I'll try to go again. It took a few times before I realized that this is what was happening. And then it started to annoy me because I get sort of lost in my train of thought. And then I realized that, is this really the culture? Because it didn't just happen in that one group of people in that specific project. Then I went on to another project and working with other folks. And I realized it was kind of the same, you know, like people are pretty aggressive. They're pretty, they can be quite domineering. They just cut you off straight away like this. So I said, you know what, if I want to be heard, I'm going to have to develop this kind of culture as well, this kind of behavior. The sad thing is I realized now I'm bringing it to other people who were not in those groups. I realized, oh no, I've now picked up that habit and I don't like it. This brings up a lot of reflections because it brings in some questions I have, like, do you think there's also, you know, later on, one of the dimensions, right, is like the masculine, feminine kind of characteristics of culture. And I find like some of these traits of being aggressive, dominant, you know, competitive, all these mm-hmm. things are identified as more masculine. I don't know how gender, if there are really, there are cultural stereotypes, but then there are gender stereotypes. And this is why maybe certain genders also are expected to behave in this manner versus myself, I'm female. The feminine behavior dictates maybe we can be a little bit more passive or just better listeners, you know, how they say about women. The question I have at the end of this is, do you think power distance plays a role in that dynamic? Because I have to admit, they were more senior people than myself. They were male. It was mixed in terms of ethnicity. Maybe define power distance. And do you think that's power distance at play in those situations?
So there are two dimensions to respond to that question. The first one is, okay, what is power distance? So power distance is a society's acceptance of inequalities or unequal distribution of power among the members, right? So you can think of cultures in the world where we expect to have a boss and the boss would have a lot more power than people who are under. Whereas other societies, everybody would be more egalitarian. The typical example would be this picture, I don't know if you ever saw it, of the Prime Minister of the Netherlands going to work on his bicycle, which is an illustration of a very low power distance society.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
In cultures that are high power distance, you would never see that.
Yeah.
The prime minister would always go to
with
work.
An entourage of 10 cars, 200 security people. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So all kind of things that would signal that there's a power. And it's not just at the level of the government or the prime minister, but this also trickle down into different level of the society.
Yeah.
Now, in societies that are high in power distance, there are some different expectations of people in different level of the hierarchy. So obviously, when you are higher in the power, you have less constraint in how to behave towards others, especially people of lower level. That is one. Now, the other thing that you highlighted about this this issue of interruptions is that cultures also differ greatly in the rules that people follow when they are communicating with each other.
Right.
And this can be related to power, but not necessarily. Mm. So in some cultures, and this is something that we see a lot in highly collectivistic societies where harmony is highly valued, then there is an expectation that when somebody talks, we have to listen to them. Mm. And people will talk in turn. People will have a lot of pause, you know, silence in their communication. But then you have other cultures where it's more acceptable and expected that people will talk a lot. These are cultures where speaking up show that you are interested, that you are passionate about the topic. It will be a way to signal your engagement in the discussion. In my experience of working with the multicultural teams, I found this is a great source of tension. Even in
the power distance or the communication?
The communication. Even in teams when there is no obvious leader. So it's not about power. Okay. It's just about cultural norms.
All right.
Where you will have students who come from what we call high context cultures. So high context are culture where the communication is more indirect. There is more pause and silence within the conversations. And people typically are trained to listen and to wait for their turn to talk.
Sure.
And then you will have, you know, other students or people from culture that are more direct, where there is a higher level of assertiveness in the communication.
Yeah.
And so when all these people are talking to each other, the ones who are more assertive, they don't have any restrictions in and no expectations in terms of turn taking, because you talk when you have something to say.
Yeah.
You talk to articulate your ideas.
Mm.
And so they will talk and talk and talk. And then you will have people who come from the more reserved cultures, the more what we call high context, the more indirect cultures, where you are trained to, you only talk when you have something to say that is very well formulated. You only talk when it's your turn, and they will be sitting there waiting for their turn to come, and their turn will never come.
But it's simple courtesy. It's not even about waiting for your turn, at least for me. I operated under the assumption that it's professional courtesy to let someone finish talking and then you can talk. You just you wait for them to finish what they're saying and then you go. Because sometimes, I mean, if you listen to them talk, they're not really even saying anything significant. They just like feel like they need to dominate the conversation, right? Yeah. So I guess that probably was one of the wake-up points, is like, where's the professional courtesy? Isn't this I thought this was like a known thing. Like this is not something I need to explain or have to think that would never happen in a workplace scenario.
And that's the difficult part, is how do you tease out the professional courtesy from the cultural upbringing?
Correct.
Because you're right. In every culture, there is still some kind of expectations that interrupting people is impolite, right?
Yes.
Yet, there are cultural norms that are not said, that might be implicit norms, in which, despite knowing that it's not polite, people are still more likely to do it. And you can really see some variations between cultures. I mean, a typical example and one of the very, very extreme, what I have seen is like Japanese people are very, very courteous. And it's built into their culture that you only talk when the other person is finished. You listen carefully and pay attention to what they're saying.
Yeah.
But other cultures do not, even if people will follow or say this, you know, they will not necessarily do it.
Yeah.
So I've noticed also another thing in myself, having lived in Asia, in China and Singapore, I really had to tone down on my excitement when I had to participate in teams, in group discussions, because I noticed at the beginning, I will always be dominating the conversation.
Yeah.
Not because I want to, but just because
that's what naturally comes to
upbringing.
You. Correct. Yeah.
Now, on top of that, personality can help,
sure,
because if you're more extroverted, you also tend to talk a lot. But still, culture plays a large role. In culture like mine, people don't necessarily communicate ideas that are well formulated.
Yeah, of
because
course.
They formulate ideas as, they,
as
talk.
They talk.
In that sense, it is cultural because that's how we do things.
Yeah.
The second thing is people are very uncomfortable with silence.
Yep. Yeah, that's
right. So as soon as somebody stops talking, somebody has to jump in because it feels so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Now, this is something that threw me off many, many times, because in my experience in China, in Singapore and in many parts of Asia, people take many pauses in their communication. They will talk, and then they will pause.
Yeah.
And then they will start talking.
Yeah.
You see, and I had never seen that before. The problem I have now is when I go back to France.
Well,
I have a big family. We are, I have 4 siblings, and when we are together, it's like 12, 13 people around the table.
Yeah.
Everybody is talking.
Yeah.
And here I am thinking, okay, when is my turn to talk?
Are
waiting
you serious?
For that moment when I can easily jump in. And half the time I would try to jump in because that's the only way for me to be able to speak up and say something. And half the time, I would do it at the wrong time.
Yeah.
The communication may sound disorganized and messy, yeah. but actually there are rules for interruption as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's a challenging part. But that's another thing that is very hard to, it's very hard to tease apart what we think is common courtesy
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
From actually the cultural...
From the culture.
Upbringing. And the thing is, even within culture that are very expressive, where people talk a lot, they may follow different rules for what is appropriate interruption, who is allowed to speak at what time. Because you talk about high power distance also influence the discussion. When somebody is of a higher power than you, you may be less likely to interrupt them, may be less likely to speak.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I find it interesting what you said. Like now when you move back to France, you now have to be a little bit more mindful about how you would interact. Meaning like that's how much you have already evolved and changed just from being away for so long, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And but it's the same problem as you.
Mm.
When you said you have become better at interrupting people and you don't like it because you feel like you do it too much.
Correct.
I also feel that I have lost my ability to do that, to be active in communication. And now I find myself a bit on the sideline when I am in those discussions with a lot of people.
No, so for me, I find that I'm now interrupting even people who are not, you know, that way. I work with a client right now. She's lovely, like super, you know, kind, laid back woman. But then when she's talking, I feel like I'm getting impatient and I start, even though she wasn't like that with me. That's when I noticed like, oh my God, I have imbibed now this culture that I have been experiencing and I don't think I like it. Or it will just take a little bit more consciousness from me that, okay, when I'm dealing with these original, you know, guys, that's how I need to be. And then when I'm with other people, I have to revert to my original courteous, respectful self and, you know, hold back. Okay, so that's power distance. You referred to collectivist societies.
Yes.
As opposed to
individualist societies. Yes.
All right. And so in collectivist societies, you're saying that's where people probably are more trained to hold back, wait for your turn, only when you have something to say. And then individualistic societies, that's where probably people are encouraged more to stand up, speak up, express yourself. Probably these are the societies also that are uncomfortable with silence because they know they're probably like just used to like, you know, somebody needs to fill this space.
Yeah.
Where do you think Singapore stands? I think I know the answer, but I want to hear it from you.
Oh, Singapore is still a very collectivistic society.
What are the characteristics of a collectivist? When you say collectivist, what does that mean?
Yeah. So in collectivist society, the needs of the groups are always more important than the needs of the individual. And there is a lot of pressure from the individual to conform to the needs of the group, which is why the norms of harmony is very high and very strong. And therefore, it influences the way people communicate with each other. There's a higher aversion to conflict and disagreement.
Can you give an example of what is a manifestation of something that is a collectivist culture?
So if you think about how countries have reacted to the pandemic, for example, wearing masks.
Uh-huh.
We know now that wearing a mask does not really protect us as individuals. The highest level of protection only exists when everybody is wearing their mask. Because when you wear your mask, it's to stop the spread of the germ to others. So it's actually you might be contaminated and you use the mask as a barrier to protect other people. Now, what we saw during the pandemic was very interesting because across countries and cultures, people had different reactions to mask rules. And so in cultures that were more individualist, many people would just say, yeah, well, I don't like it. It's not going to bring me much value. Therefore, you know, I don't want to do it.
So individualistic in this context means really just my norms, my rules, my rights.
It's putting the self above the needs of the group or the individual.
Got it.
In collectivist societies, there is a stronger norm to want to do good for the group and the society. Mm. Very early on, you know, children in school, they learn that the actions have implication on others and it's really important to be a good member of the society.
Mm-hmm.
And so people were more willing to accept these rules, quite limiting, even individual freedom. I mean, if you think about lockdowns and things like that, this was very has implication for individual rights. Mm-hmm. And we saw this happening.
Yeah. So what are the countries, off the top of your head, the most known collectivist ones? Where are they from? Which countries are they?
Actually, the interesting thing is that most countries in the world are collectivist.
Oh, really?
The countries that have highest score of individualism are in North America, in Europe, and in Australia, New Zealand.
Yeah.
Most other societies range from mid-level to very high level of collectivism, because groups serve as a safety net to the individual. When there is a disaster, when somebody loses their home, the society, the group is going to pull together their resources to help them out.
Yeah.
Now, this happens because there is no other social safety net.
Right.
As societies become more affluent, you can pool resources at a national level. Mm. So people will know, okay, if I lose my job, I will still have something.
Sure.
And so the reliance on the group become less. And another reason is more historical and related to the geography. Oh. At least this is one hypothesis. When they look at the difference between hunter-gatherers and agricultural farming societies.
Yeah.
In hunter-gathering societies, you are less dependent on others.
Okay.
Because you have your tribe and then you just go from one place to another.
The nomadic living, right?
Yeah. Yes. So you can live in more isolated groups. In farming societies, there is a higher dependence because you have access to resources, but those resources are shared. So one example would be the in the rice paddies, you know, in many parts of Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
People may have their own plot of land to grow their rice, but water is always a resource that is shared.
That's right.
And so you have to get along with your neighbor so that he doesn't cut off your water, right? And so to some extent, the value that we place about the group in relation to the individual is influenced by some of these practices and also some of these constraints. And that brings us back to the definition of culture as a solution to problems of internal integration, external adaptation.
Yeah, I'm trying to decide what the Philippines is, if it's collectivist or individualist. Maybe I think it has a little bit of both. Definitely, it's collectivist in the sense that, you know, it's a very family-oriented society. But then it can also be quite individualistic. And this is one of the biggest complaints Filipinos have about the country is people can be quite selfish or self-centered if you see it in the traffic, right? They do what's known as a counterflow, like they go in the opposite lane to get ahead of everybody. We do have some characteristics that could be individualistic. You know, we were an American colony. In some ways, we copy America a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, our constitution is a copy of the United States. Our government is a copy of the United States. We still look to America as like the culture trendsetters. Obviously, Filipino culture has its own unique characteristics. But I guess it's a little bit of both. And I'm trying to decide, is one better than the other? What is the benefit of being collectivist? What are the upsides of being individualistic?
What you describe is what we call a cultural paradox. Mm. Is that even though the society might be collectivist on average, generally, there are situations where we will observe people to act in their own self-interest. Mm. Is this not contradicting the idea of the Philippines as a collectivist society? Mm. The collectivism is a function also of the reference group. Here, we talk on the assumption that the reference group is a nation.
Right.
But not necessarily. Mm. In countries like in Singapore, maybe you will see that in Japan, in China, there is an expectation that people will act in the best interest of the country. Mm. But sometimes the reference group is not the nation and the country. It can be the family.
Yeah.
It can be the local community.
Yes,
you say
that's right.
The Philippines has 7,000 islands.
Yes.
So that's how many ethnical groups.
Yes.
You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And who don't necessarily have much in common. So in that sense, the collectivism might also be towards the closer community instead of the bigger nation.
Yeah.
There are other source of paradox. One is the situation. In collectivistic society, people are very considerate of people with whom they have a relationship with.
Yeah.
But strangers
are
seen as just that, strangers.
Yeah.
There's no relationship, therefore there's no obligation.
I don't owe you anything.
Exactly.
Yeah.
By contrast, in individualistic societies, because everybody operates as an individual, then the sense of obligation towards people who are not necessarily related to you tend to be to a certain extent higher. This has shocked me when I arrived in China. I felt like in the public space, if anything happened to me, I'm totally on my own.
Yeah.
So people will be so nice and so kind and so caring when you know them personally, when they are your friend, when they invite you in their home.
Yeah.
But as soon as you are walking in the street, people just like will walk into you and not even look at you.
Yeah.
Which was very different from my experience growing up in Europe, because in Europe, there is a courtesy in public space towards strangers. You talk about traffic rules. Okay, you have people who don't follow the rules.
But in general.
In general, there is a lot more alignment and coordination when you have to change lanes or things like that.
Yeah.
So what you describe is not necessarily a sign of individualism. It's actually part of the collectivist society. And that is also why, you know, all these things about individualism, collectivism, power distance, and all of that, you can find this information very easily on the internet. There are websites that will give you country profiles. But the starting point.
Yeah.
It's a stereotype. It's an average.
Yeah.
But it cannot explain every single individual behavior.
Of course.
Because culture is nuanced, it's complex, and also because people's behaviors, they don't just depend on their culture. Sometimes it's their personality.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's their past experience. Sometimes it's just the situation that they are in. So we have to be careful when we use this kind of knowledge about cultures.
Yes.
Because when we do, then we end up stereotyping.
I agree. And for me, at least, you know, I think stereotypes is not something we can always do away with.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say we would probably never do away with it, because the main goal of the brain is it wants to be efficient.
Yes.
And stereotyping is a way to become efficient because makes things simple for you if you put people in a box, which of course is not right, right? We know that, but our brains are wired to be more efficient. So just going back to what you said about the level of collectivism may not necessarily always be on a national level.
Mm-hmm.
One could even argue the reason why Filipinos can sometimes tend to be individualistic is the collectivism happens at the regional level. So you will find that if you come from a certain province, then you identify as that province. Like, oh, I am Pampanggeño first before I'm Filipino. You know, I'm Batanggeño before I'm Filipino. And in that sense, they have that collectivist identification within that region. So yeah, I find that interesting when you said that collectivism isn't always at a national level. There's different levels, right? There's the family level. Like, I belong to a big clan. Just on my father's side alone, there are 8 siblings. I think I counted. I have 28 first cousins on my father's side alone.
Okay.
We easily reach, I think, 80, 100 people when we get together once a year for Christmas, you know?
Wow.
And definitely it's collectivist when everybody gets together. And power distance.
Yes.
Because, you know, the elders, which is basically my dad's generation, they decide when the party happens, where it's going to happen. Like that hierarchy, power distance is very strong there. And then there are the cousins, which is my generation. And the cousins have slightly higher power than obviously the in-laws, the people they married, right? And then the next generation, which is obviously the kids now, like my nieces, my nephews. At that generation, there's very strong collectivism, because like what you said, right? When you start out in school, you're taught to follow the teacher, follow authority. So even in a supposedly casual family setting like that, the children, they take turns. There are certain rules when we get together at our family reunions. You can see that strong culture, collectivist culture is there. So yeah, I just wanted to share about that, because that's a level of collectivism right there. Even though I guess there are instances of individualism. Like, I have now a nephew who has changed his gender and changed his name now to a female name to signal that. That would have been unheard of in my time. Like, in 20, 30 years, that's how much the culture has changed. I have another niece also who doesn't want to be defined by her gender. So she also changed her name to a genderless name.
Wow.
You know, and the grandparents, my uncle, my dad, this is what now they're struggling with, right? We say Filipino society is conservative, but this is what I mean, like trickles of dualistic society influence is starting now also to trickle down into a supposedly conservative Catholic society. So anyway, I just wanted to share that. Different layers of collectivism. It's quite interesting. So masculine and feminine dimensions. So very traditional definition, I suppose.
Yeah, so the masculine and feminine dimension of culture, nowadays people use less and less those terms.
Oh, really?
Because it's based on the assumption that certain type of behavior are more typical of different genders. Another way to describe this dimension would be competitive, cooperative. In culture that are highly competitive, there is a preference and a norm to be very assertive, to have a lot of achievements, also to have a preference for material rewards and any kind of external physical material signs of success, like having a big watch, a big car, a big house.
Status,
yes, by opposition to cooperative, which would be more focused on social harmony, the quality of relationship with others. In the global ranking, the country that scored the highest on this dimension of cooperation are the Scandinavian countries that tend to be highly egalitarian with very high level of social welfare and support. There is also a stronger emphasis on work-life balance, on quality of life.
So I can start to see mapping of the different dimensions, like low power distance, individualistic, cooperative. Are there like dimensions that you can kind of, you see, like if they're individualistic, they tend to be low power distance, and then they also tend to be cooperative and feminine, and all, you know what I mean? Like,
There are some relation with the dimensions, although it's not as
clear cut,
right? To give you an example, the United States rank very highly on the competitive dimension. Despite also ranking very highly on the individualism dimension.
I see. That is a contradiction, because let's say for the Scandinavians that are individualistic, but they are cooperative. Like they look out for each other.
They are relatively more individualistic. They are also more egalitarian, but also more more collaborative. So in that sense, the collaborative dimension is not the same as a you know, you could say that it has a lot of commonalities because there is an emphasis on social harmony and social relations. But at the same time, it's different in the sense that collectivism is really about relation within a group of people with whom we feel a sense of obligation. Now, in terms of the associations between those dimensions, in collectivistic societies, there is a higher power distance. You have this saying, the birds that fly above the flock is the first one to get shot. I think it's a Chinese saying, but it's nobody wants to stand out. Now, if nobody wants to stand out, you still need to get things done. So the way things get done is through the hierarchy.
So if I go back to the example of my family, right? It's collectivist, but it's also very high power distance. And the communication, definitely, that is definitely reflected. You know, in the Philippines, we have a word that you attach at the end of every sentence to convey respect. Which is po or opo. So when you talk to somebody, anybody who is just a bit more senior to you in age, you attach this this word to show respect. So collectivist, the power distance is high. I definitely see a lot of reflection to that. I guess where I struggle is still this idea that a society can be collectivist, but then not necessarily cooperative. Because I would assume those actually go together. The cooperative meaning there's strong social welfare support. Is that right? So, but I don't know. This is a tough one. If I look at the example of the Philippines, I would still argue there is strong collectivism. But I don't know if you can say that the welfare system is strong, but that's also a result of just like not being a very wealthy country. I guess the support comes from different channels, you know, like neighbors, friends, family, very strong social network. So I wonder if that's also part of it, right?
And this dimension of cooperation competition is not limited to social welfare. It's also related to what people prioritize. So it's also related to the pace of life.
Sure.
So competitive societies, people are constantly on the go. They want to achieve, collect awards.
Yes,
you know, work-life balance is something that is,
is
looked at with suspicion.
Yeah.
Cooperation is back to enjoying the process, you know, instead of just focusing on the goal. I was in France recently and I can really feel a difference. Singapore is a very, very competitive society. It's small, but it's high density, so it's very packed. There is a need as a country to exist.
Yeah.
And in order to exist, it has to be placed on the map. So to me, on the map, you had to be recognized, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And to be recognized, the best way to do that is through awards and all kinds of achievements.
Yeah.
There is also some influence of the Chinese culture, because many people in Singapore are second,
Chinese,
third generation immigrants from China. China historically is also a highly competitive society with a lot of people. They invented the first national exam for university, meaning that anybody could access university irrespective of where they came from and how rich or poor they were. But that also meant people working really, really hard.
Yeah.
To do this. In France, the pace of life is much slower. That does not to say that people don't achieve things and they don't do great things.
Yeah.
But there is different expectations in how people live their lives.
Yeah.
Work-life balance is something that everybody is after. So if you look at the Philippines compared to Singapore, you could also already say that, yes, it's a lot more cooperative, more relational, where things are slower than it would be
more social
in Singapore.
Like, stronger social networks. No, I agree. And I guess that's a struggle that I have whenever we talk about the cooperative, competitive, long work hours, because this is something I also struggle with. Like you mentioned, okay, France has a 35-hour work week, and yet it is one of the world's wealthiest countries. Singapore, you know, very competitive. You have a lot of workaholics here, and because people are encouraged to achieve. But then when you look at it, they're already wealthy, but then would they ever slow down? People work hard because they have all these external problems. They need to secure resources. Yeah. They want to put their names on the map. And how is that possible when you don't work as hard? You don't need to work as hard. And somehow you are still able to innovate. You are still able to achieve. That's always like the comment I hear from people who move over to Singapore and are shocked by how hard people work over here. And you can say like, well, that's why they're rich. But then you go to countries like Australia or even Scandinavian countries where people are a lot more laid back. In Australia, they knock off at 4 p.m., you know, and that's like, that's pub time, you know, everybody disappears and starts drinking. But yet it's one of the world leaders economically as well, right? This contradiction is something that I struggle with.
But I mean, remember we said that the culture is a solution to problems. People adaptation to very concrete and practical problems. And we also have to look at culture in a broader context. It's like here we are talking about hundreds of years, if not thousands of years of history.
Sure.
The history of Singapore is very young. It's 50 years.
Yeah, that's right.
And so every country, every culture have different starting points. Even if we bring it back to the culture you develop with your roommate, You already gave two examples of living with different roommates. You had different starting points.
Yeah.
You had different conditions. You know, you had different people.
Yeah.
You had different resources, different environments, and all of that. So how culture is going to evolve, we don't know.
Nice.
But the thing is, culture evolved. Culture changed. The culture of Singapore today is different from it was 50 years ago and from it was 100 years ago. And it's just because humans adapt to things that happen to them. And as they adapt, some of the ideas change. So if you and I leave Singapore today and go back in 20 years, the culture will also very much be different from what it is today.
I'm glad you opened this topic up because this is a burning question. Does a culture change? And when it does, what changes and what typically does not change? But we will answer that in our next episode.
Okay.
So thank you again, Catherine, for another interesting discussion.
Thank you, Ting.
Until our next conversation, and to everybody else out there, have a nice day.
Thank you for listening. If you're interested to learn more about cultural intelligence, follow me on LinkedIn at Dr. Catherine Wood.